Ready to get to work? Good afternoon. We'll start this work session, and I will simply turn it over to Joe and to Kurt to take us away.
Well, good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Joe Zender, Chief Planner with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and today we're having a work session about the housing component of the proposed comprehensive plan. And the information we're going to be speaking from is in the briefing packet in front of you, and like we did at the last work session, we're going to refer to the page where the relevant data is as we go through this. But first, I wanted to just do a little introduction. First of all, the Director of Planning and Sustainability, Susan Anderson, was going to be here today, was unfortunately home ill, so I'm filling in at least for this introduction piece for her. And let's start with an observation that in many ways, the housing issues that we're facing and that you all have been talking about all month are in part because we've been too successful in planning and building a livable city. It's been 40 years in the making, but Portland finds itself as part of this nationwide wave of people choosing to live in walkable urban neighborhoods. Our version of it is to call it a city of complete neighborhoods, but the supply of those neighborhoods, both in Portland and nationally, isn't increasing rapidly enough. Joe Courtwright, a widely quoted local economist, has observed, he says, it's not so much a lack of housing, it's a lack of cities. And what he means by that is these great places, these great cities that the new demographic are choosing to move to. Their demand exceeds supply. And one of the facts that's quoted to illustrate that is, at one time, less than a decade ago, homes in the suburbs sold for 9% more than homes in the city. And so in less than a decade, the opposite's true. And Portland homes sell at a 7% premium over the suburbs. The demand is here. So as you heard at the last work session, the good news is we have enough zoned capacity for residential to meet our forecast demand. The whole strategy in this particular comp plan is to use that growth to build increase access to complete neighborhoods. And in those, even though we have enough zone capacity, those places we're trying to create are places where we need to protect and possibly expand development capacity. That's where we want the development to go. Among the challenges we're going to face is that the amount and character of the housing that's going to make up the city and that we're going to see growing over the next 20 years is going to be different. It's going to be mixed-use, multifamily. It's the type of market, it's the type of housing the market for is growing nationally. It's sort of essential to us to be able to keep up with the mix of housing and incomes that we want in the city. It's important especially because we want it to grow into centers and corridors to be able to create these healthy, complete neighborhoods. A second challenge, and this is the one you've been talking about quite a bit lately, is the increased pressure on housing affordability. And this, resultingly, will have an impact on income diversity and equity within Portland. In terms of today's presentation, the first section of our work session is going to be devoted to housing market dynamics, supply, demand, and mostly the market rate housing component. And the second session, the second component after a Q&A break, will be devoted to affordability and those policies in the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan has a whole chapter and variety of policies spread throughout the plan devoted to housing, but it rolls up into this. The heart of the strategy is to increase the supply of housing at all income levels. So we need more housing to stay competitive, to keep supply and demand aligned. That's more housing production, more walkable and complete neighborhoods made up of this housing, more housing choice, types of units and size of units and prices of units in our single family neighborhoods in our high opportunity areas. And then the second part of the strategy is really to increase the supply of permanently affordable housing. We got to produce as much housing as we can. We need to increase local funding. This is what's recommended in the comprehensive plan. As a local source of funding for affordable housing, we need to increase housing stability and renter protections. So as we did in the last section, we'll be working from your workbooks today. And with that, I'll go into the discussion of our first item, which is housing dynamics and conditions. Okay. this is going to be, so in this section, I'm going to start off with some discussion of the housing market. Eric's going to complete with a discussion of the housing types and the mix of units that we have. So first, a couple of definitions. I'm going to use the term affordable housing in this discussion, and here we're talking about just households of low and moderate income, at low and moderate incomes making less than 80% of median family income, regardless of where they live, in a program that we subsidize or a program on the market. That's affordable housing, is housing that meets those needs. Regulated affordable housing, we're referring specifically to units that receive some kind of public subsidy, publicly owned, nonprofit, abatements, Section 8, public housing, or other incentives. That's the stock that we consider permanently affordable at this time. So with that, let's go to page one of your, make sure it's page two, excuse me. So let's talk about housing market conditions and dynamics in the city. Primarily, what this first graphic shows is that the city has been adding people faster than it's been adding housing. So over the last 5 years, Portland's population has increased by 46,000, and we've only added 12,000 new housing units. This has put pressure on the housing market and increased housing costs. As you can see from the amended sort of graph that we just handed out, there's this period from 2006 to roughly 2013 where, by a significant margin, population growth exceeded the amount of housing we built. That sort of represents a large population looking for housing in Portland, much of which has more income, bidding up the prices of housing. What you see starting in 2013 is the lines start to converge and they're moving up at the same rate. It suggests, although it's just 1 year of data, that we're starting to come out of that significant sort of imbalance, but you see we have a lot to make up for those decades where, and where the population change was growing at a faster pace.
Just a technical note. The reason we substituted the graphic is the old one was the, for the decade in the early 2000s, we used the information that they had collected then as opposed to the revised backward forecast of, corrected forecast of what we now think the population was then, if that made sense.
Welcome, Howard.
Joe?
Yeah.
Joe, how useful is this chart in that it aggregates all the data? So while it shows us in the aggregate, it doesn't really help us understand the match between the kind of people coming and the needs for housing and what's being produced.
Oh, I think that's what the rest of this morning is going to address. Okay. But one data point to that particular issue. Since 2007,
I was admonished earlier, if we don't push the button, it doesn't actually,
it doesn't go on the cable.
We don't get the text on the bottom.
Okay, since 2007, virtually all of the household growth in Portland has been in the high-income bracket. So we're growing, and you're going to see this in the next slide, which is the relationship between wages and housing prices. But it is, just like you're saying, it's not uniform growth. There's an increase in the number of low-income households, increase in the number of higher-wage households, a decrease in the proportion of the middle. So two, so while housing growth, this is the second sort of dynamic I wanted to point out, but housing prices are growing, but wages are staying flat overall. And as I just said, even though wages are staying flat overall, this is another one where if you're looking at the average, it looks flat. Even in the changes over the last few years, are where it is growing is in the higher income households, interested in living in our neighborhoods, bidding up housing prices, displacing folks with less income and bidding up prices elsewhere. Third dynamic, or third sort of chart I wanted to show you, sort of brings the both of these, all of these pieces together. And this is simply the average rent compared to the vacancy rate. You know, this has been an important story in Portland for a few years now, actually, where we have at one time the nation's lowest vacancy rate. The vacancy rate lack of supply, you're bidding up rents, and the dynamic is this. New units are being built, and the fact that they can get rents that make it worth building a new unit is part of why it's happening. So this is a dynamic that spurs the construction of new market rate units. Eventually, they will converge back again when enough of those new units are built. That helps the overall picture. It doesn't necessarily help the affordability picture. So part of what I wanted to talk about next is the elements of the overall supply of housing. Overall supply of housing. Just shows you that our total housing supply has got units affordable to moderate and higher income, units affordable to lower income households, and even a smaller proportion of those are the units that we actually have in our affordable housing program. So a significant number of the households who are low-income households are having to find housing on the private market even already, and it's safe to say that many of those households are cost burdened. But the amount that we actually produce in our affordable housing programs is only one piece of the puzzle. So if there's a growth in demand at the higher income households, it pushes on that supply and starts to have parts of what would be typically lower income households or lower income apartments moved up, rehabbed, prices go up, supply goes down. You need the whole supply to grow to be able to keep the housing supply and prices in balance. Across the city, we're going to grow. We're forecast to grow by 123,000 households. We need to make space and assure sort of a path where that can happen, and then continue to work on how we provide affordable housing as well. Then with all of that, with all that increase in supply, the point I'd like to make here is that is not sufficient to address affordable housing. And as you saw in the state of the city housing, the state of housing report, today and continuing into the future, large parts of Portland are unaffordable, or households will be cost burdened today and as we move forward.
I'm looking at this market filtering box and trying to understand what is that trying to convey.
Right, I'm sorry I didn't explain that. So that is simply this notion. It's kind of a fancy name for something pretty straightforward. As you build new units, older units become lower price often. The overall demand, if you're building fast enough, those older units become lower price relative to everything, often become the source of housing, affordable housing for workforce housing, and some go down to low-income households. It's related to that point where most of the households who are low-income households are finding some way and somehow housing on the private market, not as part of our program units. If you grow the overall supply, the way the theory works is that you also are helping protect the supply, the market supply, for lower-income households. It's not sufficient, but it's a part of the puzzle. That's what filtering is, Commissioner.
Joe or Kurt, when will we have some good data on the impact of short-term rentals on the housing stock?
Well, that's a great question, because the short-term rentals are just emerging as a typology. I think we can address it, I think, in our next state of housing update by looking at a transect of the short-term rental market, and that is what is being permitted. We know that some are flying under the radar. We're not probably going to capture all of them. But the nexus between the loss of affordable housing and the short-term rental market is strong. We know it's not exclusively limited to conversion of existing units, but some people are building new units or adapting existing household structures to accommodate an ADU for the short-term rental market. So we haven't been able to net that out yet. But it's a fast-moving target that we'd like to invest some more serious time into. The other thing about filtering, which I think bears mentioning here, is that even though you have market-affordable units that statistically are affordable to people with incomes under 80% of median income, it doesn't mean that the people that occupy those units are of lower moderate income. In fact, landlords have a lot of leverage right now. They can take 10 rental applications from 10 different households, and they can pick and choose who they want to be in that unit. And it may be a subtle form of economic discrimination, but they often will choose people with the highest credit score. And therefore, people who are able to rent perhaps higher cost housing are choosing not to do so. And that's an economic decision that they make. Filtering goes up and down. It can go up as people with higher incomes move into an area, as they are in North and East Portland. And at some point, neighborhoods, Camden, New Jersey, Detroit, have seen filtering go the other way. We happen to see filtering going upwards, not downwards. And there are market interventions, such as housing rehab, preservation of existing rental stock in areas that have a high degree of market affordability, to help preserve that and to then encourage the owners to go into a regulated market environment with financial incentives.
So just to follow up on that, I actually had forgotten that we authorize people to have ADUs be solely for short-term rentals. And I can't remember why we authorized that, because it seems like that's sort of like inconsistent with the idea that the reason we allow ADUs is to increase density, and you're not really increasing density for residents by allowing people to build an ADU just as a hotel. So does anybody remember why we decided to do that?
Well, I think you were persuaded by the argument, too, that it's also a source of income that can help keep someone in their house. I think that's what the line of argument was at that day, but it also plays the way you say, Commissioner. And just to wrap up on this piece, part of the point of talking about filtering and the overall housing supply is that there's a lot of argument out there that the new development is causing housing prices to go up because new units are more expensive. They're new. But that's not really the dynamic. The dynamic is that the supply and demand, the fact that people want units, have more money, there's a low vacancy rate is making it possible and attracting development to happen. And they're shooting for the high end of the market because it's a business, and that's what the way that part of this works.
This is a table-pounding diatribe from our friend Joe Courtwright. Housing prices cause development, not the other way around.
Right.
He's pretty fervent about that.
So I know it seems the change, and when you see them go up and you see housing prices go up, it seems like that's the cause. The cause is something else, and if we don't keep our eye on that, we'll miss the mark. So that's the other point of this whole filtering discussion. So let me just cover two more things real quickly, and I'll turn it over to Eric. Let's look out to 2035. So our strong housing market demand is expected to continue. In part, we're going to add 123,000 households by 2035. So we have to, or we'll want to house those folks, and it's about 6,000 households per year. It's aggressive, but as you saw in the last work session, it's not inconsistent with the rate that we have been growing. So we feel pretty confident that we will stay on that path and be able to accomplish it. Secondly, the nature of the households in the city with that growth and over time are going to be changing. We're going to be increasingly diverse. Today, we're about 28% of the population of people of color, and by 2035, that will be well over 30. We have increasing education attainment. That kind of goes along with the high-wage jobs and who might be coming to town that we were talking about. By 2035, we're going to have 5,000 more households or so with children, but the proportion of households with children in the city is going to go down. So overall, there will be more, but as a proportion of our total growth, there'll be a slight decrease.
Where are we at now in comparison with 5-10 years ago in terms of households with children, percentage-wise?
This 2010 number at 27%. I don't know what the interim numbers are off the top of my head, Commissioner. I believe that it's been always going down slightly, but this is more dramatic than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, if you could get me the trend over the last 10 years, I'd be really interested, because 10 years ago it was predicted that all the families are fleeing, and then every event I go to, there's gazillions of families with small children.
But the point is also this, as we grow, the fact that the proportions go down, there's still going to be 5,000 more households with children. So it's just The number of households that are sort of oriented towards and concerned about are in the economic position of trying to house children as well will be smaller, but there's still more households with children.
It's also related to the aging population and the fact that people are waiting longer to have kids. So a smaller share of their lifespan is with children. So even if everyone still has kids, the overall number at any one time with kids goes down.
So that's that's sobering for the education community that wants to pass bond measures, because you're talking about more school-age kids, but a smaller percentage of households that have a school-age child. I think the statistic now, Steve, is about 20% of households have a school-age child, so it makes the challenge of passing a bond measure, to a degree of difficulty, harder, because a lot of households don't have a school-age child, but fortunately understand the benefit of someone getting a good education or going to a quality school. We'll have more kids, but fewer households as a percentage.
Right. Two more demographic points that I think are related and interesting. So size of household is going to be decreasing. 2.3 is what it is today. It's going to go down to around 2 persons per household. And by 2035, 60% of our households are going to be in 1 or 2 person households, and a large proportion of those will be elderly households. There was a housing forum at PSU last Friday, and one of the data points that their keynote speaker raised was just the order of magnitude of downsizing older households in terms of who's going to be demanding units of these new units that are built in the future. And so the market's going to respond to folks doing that part. It's going to be a major characteristic change in terms of what people are looking for and where they're looking for housing. Finally, the demographic change I wanted to address was income. And based on the Metroscope forecast, that between now and 2035, once again, the proportion of households who are considered low income in Portland are going to increase. This is based on looking at the forecast, but it's not sort of destiny, in that if the housing price and supply dynamics stay as they are today, many folks who would be in that low-income household column would be displaced from town, potentially out to the rest of the region. Also, that 49%, to the extent that it does reflect increasing housing prices across the city by 2035, is the high end of low-income, if you can imagine. They're finding units on the market. So it's a change, but the overall proportion still continues to grow. With that, I want to turn it over to Eric to talk about housing types.
Thank you, Joe. So the comp plan, I think as Joe mentioned, is a tool, one tool in housing, but it's not the only tool. It does shape the type and location of housing that ends up getting built over the next 20 years, and so it is a really critical tool and can affect affordability. Joe mentioned we don't have an overall numbers problem in that we have enough zoning in the aggregate to accommodate 123,000 households, but I want to talk a little bit about where that is and in what form and discuss a little bit how that may work. We do have a surplus of capacities, zoned land for multifamily housing relative to the projections. So that gives us a little bit of flexibility to be very thoughtful about where we put zoning and where we put where we allow development. So I want to just make that point. To get our head around this issue, as I mentioned before, we did an analysis of a variety of different growth scenarios given different zoning configurations and given different demographic shifts. What we do is we look at the zoning map. So a fundamental principle here is that different zones on the zoning map, of course, allow different types of housing. So that tells us something about the future if we understand where our vacant and underutilized land is and what zoning it has. If all our vacant and underutilized land is in single-family low density, that's one thing. If it's all in the Pearl District, that's another. And so we went through an exercise to understand that mix of what the zoning combined with where our vacant land is, what that would likely produce over a 20-year period. We also wrapped in building permit trends so that we understand, you know, which neighborhoods are experiencing the more pressure in the market relative to other places. We may have a lot of capacity in one neighborhood, but have no evidence that there's been any development in the last 10 years. So we try to be sober about our forecast and not over-forecast growth if we haven't seen evidence of it. So the spatial distribution of housing, we've mentioned this in the earlier work session, that about 80% of growth will be multifamily housing. And so that's going to change us from a city that's 60% single family to a city that's, at the end of that 20-year period, it'll flip. So it's 40-60 the other way, 60% multifamily, 40% single family or multifamily. So this matters, again, because of different types of housing, of course, have different levels of affordability and accommodate different household types, even if they're at the same income levels. And we need to look at the full life cycle of young families, singles, all the way up to people who are downsizing after their kids have left home. So what we've done, again, is to look at that mix. In your packet is a chart.
Page 9.
Thank you. So page 9, and what it shows is on the left is a chart that shows you the mix of housing types right now that we have on the ground. And so about 46% of our housing stock today is in large lot, single-family detached housing. 30% is multifamily corridors or mixed-use apartments. We have about 6% of the total housing in more high-rise central city development. If you look at, like, in the middle there, there's kind of the middle housing spectrum of there's about 3% of the housing stock is in duplexes. And again, given the land use map and the where and the location of vacant land and building permit trends, the pie chart on the right shows what we're forecasting the result of our proposed comp plan would be. So it does, the numbers of large lot single family homes go up because there is still growth in all of these sectors, but as a share it goes down because the other sectors are growing faster. You can see then that combined effort, no one slice of the pie changes dramatically, but the combined changes of the left side of the pie growing faster than the right pushes the overall nature of housing in a different direction. You can see that the high-rise or mid-rise apartments grows in size. The mixed use goes up a little bit as a percentage, but it's quite a bit of a numerical increase. It's worth noting that that middle housing slice stays about the same as a percentage of the housing supply.
I'm wondering about different housing types. I'm going to pass around. This is what we call a semi-detached in England, and it looks like a mayor assigned me on my vacation to go take lots of pictures of semis. They're similar to the duplex, except that they can be owned, and they don't have to be on a corner. So there's that kind. And then the other thing that I thought you were going to be looking into as part of the info process is conversion of larger, older homes in single-family neighborhoods and allow them to be condos.
That is something that has been put on for discussion. And that would be one way of trying to increase the supply of that middle housing. We have the overall policy focus has been to, because of the demographics that Joe mentioned, as a matter of policy, to try and increase the diversity of the supply. In addition to what he mentioned about increasing the overall supply, because of the changing nature of households, we do need to diversify the choices in the housing stock. And so we are trying to diversify that pie, if you will. And so we're looking at ways of how can we, and the middle housing has been a focus there of from an affordability perspective, the place between the large lot single family and the penthouse condominium downtown is the more inherently affordable housing stock. And it doesn't mean it will be affordable if there's other market dynamics going on, but at least part of this exercise is to make sure that we haven't stacked the dice, so to speak, by only allowing the expensive housing types in the comp plan.
So there's another layer of data that it would be interesting to hear or even see depicted, and that is, you look at these pie slices, so, apartments of various configurations, right, in the three orange slices represent somewhere around 110,000 units now, and you show that representing about 150,000 units. I'm very quickly, badly adding the column. But it would appear to me, from just what I've seen in permits and activity, that we are perhaps about on track over the 20-year period at the current rate of apartment construction, right? If they keep building apartments at the same rate they're building them now, we'll build this many. I'm guessing. I want you to inform this answer. I suspect we are way below that rate of production on single family and way below that on a couple of different attached configurations, single family residential duplex attached. So inform my hunches about that. My sense is we're going gangbusters on apartments. We may be meeting our production goal of what's necessary to accommodate the population there. I suspect we're falling way short in single family and way, way short in duplexes and attached. Yeah. But wrong am I?
I think you're about right. The single family housing market has been slower to rebound from the recession than the multifamily, in part because most people are in the rental market. The mortgage system changed pretty fundamentally after the recession, and so young families starting up have to wait longer, and it's harder to get ownership. So they're in rental housing longer. In the middle housing, there is that kind of construction going on, the small lot infill and the. That's where the land supply question may be more of an issue. That overall, again, we have a lot of single family capacity. There's a lot of large properties out in Pleasant Valley or in the outer edges of the city where you could build new subdivisions. But that isn't that middle, more affordable slice where it's the small lot, maybe smaller than 3,000 square feet, where you can have a yard, but it's still within the price range of someone who's starting out.
Explicate that explanation in a table that shows number of units in this category today, number of units needed in 2035, current rate of production needed. Not every year is the same, obviously, but it would be good for me anyway to see that how we doing, a dashboard, how we doing in each of these subcategories of housing, because that's going to ultimately inform, I think, not only the commission's, but also the council's judgment calls about the map, about the allocation of that land supply.
Great. One other thing that's shown by these two pie charts is that to hit these goals that we're talking about, especially the diversity goals, we need production and change across all of these types of areas and all of these housing products. And one of the things that it seems like to us is that, you know, these the row house, the stacked flat, these kind of attached housing products that we're talking about may be this decade's version of the ADU. When you think about how the ADU market was something that we felt like we had a spark and subsidized and it took off and now it can support itself, we think. This housing type has been slow to take up in Portland, and it's really critical for middle housing for us to hit our numbers and give more types of household income as households chances to live in our inner neighborhoods where the opportunities are high. And it's not new because up until the 50s, our zoning allowed it everywhere. And that's why you see some of the inner neighborhoods developed the way they are, a mix of duplexes, triplexes, mixed use, and single family.
And remember, it's the net increase, so it doesn't necessarily help the overall supply if we've torn down a house and replaced it with a bigger house. It's the net increase that is the issue.
Perhaps add is that there is room for product innovation in that particular segment of the market. As mentioned, the UK and Canada have slightly different inflections on the same product. In Vancouver, British Columbia, which matches San Francisco for housing prices, they have something called laneway housing, where they've essentially permitted what you would call a detached ADU or a DADU, and they allow lot splits. So they've turned the alleyway into the public realm, or they've returned an alley into the public realm and created a secondary street, so you can actually sell that detached unit. Eric and I have talked a little bit about how that might work here. Not all of our blocks have alleys, so there's an issue there. And whether the standards are sufficient for PBOT and environmental services is an open question. But it does raise the point that if there's purchasing power for that middle segment, does it not make sense to provide an ownership option? Right now, it's really not an option, but it could be.
And that raises the street plan issue, which I will continue to raise, because there are giant blocks of asphalt on 82nd Avenue that could have an alley platted into the redevelopment pattern if that's what we require.
So we're in the part of the agenda now where we've left 30 minutes for discussion of this first part, so I just want to throw it open, and actually we're on time, which is that's amazing.
One additional note.
Want to follow up right on with the observation the mayor just made about 82nd, for instance. You know, when we talk about centers and corridors, and you're going to hear this a lot in the comprehensive plan, 82nd's a classic corridor. And we want to grow in complete neighborhoods. You sort of have a sense of what that's like. They're not the same thing everywhere. We have a sense that, you know, our inner neighborhoods are rich in them. East Portland and some of our outer neighborhoods aren't yet because they were developed in a different time in a different way. And I know it's hard for us to imagine, but some of our greatest land supply for growth is in places like 82nd, is on places like Barber, and is on places like Sandy. And Sandy's actually, of the three, those three examples, the most one that you could sort of see the most. But imagine turning those arterials into places that register more like centers and contribute to the neighborhoods on either side of the street. Your Montevilla's, you know, Montevilla, for instance, is cut off by 82nd. But 82nd could benefit from the asset that is Montevilla. That's just an example. So that's a long-run play, but that is the play that makes our ambitious goals actually more within grasp.
One note on your question about the recent permit trends. We are seeing, along with the single-family development in the recent past, a much higher share of that occurring with an ADU from the get-go. And that's partly, I think, being driven by the prices are now high enough so that it's pushing many middle-class families out of reach for those mortgages. And so the home builders have figured out that if they bundle an ADU with it, they can reach a different demographic and that they can get a lender to account for that. So it's the market is a little bit responding by starting to build ADUs as a standard practice with new single family, in part because the prices have gotten so high that that's the only way anyone can buy them.
Question for Kurt. Based on what we know today and what we're projecting over the next 20 years, if you had one extra dollar to spend today for a certain kind of housing, looking through your lens as the director of the Housing Bureau, where would you spend it?
Well, I think the greatest value are in the transit corridors. I'd probably want to invest, frankly, in land in the Division Powell, Barber, Boulevard corridors where bus rapid transit is planned and where the typology of a mid-rise, mixed-use mid-rise product would make the most sense. I'd look for catalytic corners that could be placemaking opportunities in areas that are otherwise missing an identity. because public funds should be used as the jet fuel, if you will, to help catalyze private investment. And, you know, I would be sparing, I would try to focus in those areas to help lead the private sector into those areas to produce other similarly good and affordable product.
Well, there's just to add on to that, there's one other angle, especially on Powell Division that we've seen, which is those neighborhoods, especially Inner Powell, are rich in small multifamily buildings. There's actually a lot of density in those neighborhoods now, but they're small garden units, small property owners, not the big sort of real estate chains, and probably workforce housing costs, at least for a while. They're going up, of course. Preservation of those for affordable housing plays right into what Kurt's saying, and this is what we've actually been trying to work with the Housing Bureau on at their sort of lead. What's the opportunity there? How do you raise the resources for it? How do you get in front of this transit investment? The bus rapid transit's one, and it will have some impact, but if and when we do a next high-capacity transit line like Barber, it could make you're going to see even more dramatic changes.
Joe, just one question for you. I'm looking at the chart on page 3 about what happened during the recession, and I'm actually intimately familiar with that since that was the beginning of my service on the council. Do we land bank now and risk being at the top of the market, or do we wait for the next market correction and then get more bang for the buck?
There's more art than science in that, predicting bubbles and voids. But I do think that in a resource-constrained market like Portland, that if there is a correction, it won't be a dramatic correction. If you look at the nosedive that we saw in terms of population change in 2010, we can all remember that there were pencil towers in the Pearl that were leasing for less than cost. But it was only for about 18 months that they were leasing for less than cost, and there was a market correction. This is not Phoenix. We don't have an abundance of product that we can get out of sync with our market demands for. So I'd say be very strategic right now in looking for those catalytic sites. Don't buy land without a purpose and without discipline. if possible, not to pay public agencies for public land, because that's already in de facto banked. It's already in the public sector. But look for privately owned properties that are perhaps in family trust that would otherwise be lost to speculation and that you wouldn't have a shot at it otherwise.
Just want to acknowledge John Gray, because it was John Gray who had the foresight to give Habitat all that money, which they then used in the recession to acquire land that developers abandoned or because deals stalled, and allowed them to, you know, turbocharge development in places like, you know, Outer East, Centennial. Now he could not have accurately forecast that, but it was the convergence of having money to do the land banking, to do development that met community needs, taking advantage of the recession.
Yep.
And a lot of those were projects that developers had stalled out or cashed out because it just didn't see a future.
Well, just so you know, not all land banks are created equal. We will bring to council a proposal where, by using city monies through the Network for Affordable Housing, or NOAA, there would be an opportunity to hold land for 36 to 48 months while the nonprofit or for-profit developers agreeing to provide affordable housing don't have to pay high debt service on that property while they accumulate resources. That's a short-term hold, and it's a bridge financing tool which allows us to help decrease the cost of development. Banking in its purest form is beyond that 5-year time frame, so that you would be looking perhaps at the next business cycle and keeping some resources in reserve so that you can act when the market may falter or a developer may try to sell permitted inventory. I mean, the best inventory you can find are properties that are already entitled but not yet built, so that you don't have to then go through the entitlement process.
I keep adding, but one other thing to think about is this kind of land banking that Kurt just talked about. At some point, especially around our transit projects, we it'd be interesting to think of it as infrastructure, because the link between transit and this sort of preservation or creation of affordable housing, at least even from the federal government, is sort of expected now. And we have a policy about high opportunity areas, access to work, you know, good transit is one of those things. I think, as you heard this morning, to be able to live in a household and not depend on a car saves you $10,000 a year. So it's really, you know, missing a business cycle is one thing. Taking the time to capitalize a land bank period is probably no short period of time for us as well. And we have a couple of major transit lines coming. So I'd like to also encourage the Planning and Sustainability Commissioners who've joined us today to chime in with anything. They were the ones who, for months and months, helped us sort through these housing issues. The second part we're going to move into is going to be about the affordable housing and anti-displacement policies, but the market rate housing is what we've been discussing first. So.
I've got a question for you all. I mean, Eric was saying that we have theoretically enough zoned multifamily areas that we can anticipate, I mean, we can accommodate the anticipated growth. But is it in the right place? I mean, if you had your druthers, would you say, no, I want more multifamily housing in places where the zoning doesn't exist now and maybe less in places where it does exist now?
I'll start, Eric. Go ahead. I think it is in the right place. We had, I think, good discussions about outer East Portland and how much housing was going to occur there versus downtown versus the neighborhoods. And so when you look at housing, I think it's equally distributed. I mean, and there's a part of the housing policy is really this equitable distribution of housing so that everybody shares in that housing. Whether it's affordable or whatever. The key, though, is trying to, over the next 25 years, make sure it is distributed so that today it's zoned so it could be in the corridors, in outer east downtown, along Barber Boulevard, northeast Portland, southeast, southwest, but trying to make sure that in that period you just don't build in one neighborhood because it's easy or because the transit is all there. And that's the difficulty that I see. I think the zoning is there. The policies are there. How do you now direct a market that says Southwest is the hot place to build and you build all your affordable housing because of you take advantages of certain criteria and you don't, it ends up not being equally distributed.
I was going to say there's probably legal restrictions to that too when we're looking at fair housing, right? We can't have affordable housing all concentrated in one particular area, especially if it's not located close to opportunity areas. And I think with, I like how we're talking about a catalytic investment, but not necessarily what's catalytic to charge the market to create business or to create market rate. But we're also talking about those catalytic public investments for maintaining and retaining affordable land and property. So I wanted to throw that in there.
I would say that when we answer that question, we need to go back to what are our goals and what larger objectives do we have in the performance of the comp plan. And we did try and lay that out in this growth scenarios report and spell out specifically what objectives we thought we were chasing in terms of affordability and being a low-carbon city and having good transit use. And so if you buy those objectives, we looked at different places and where development could occur. And in an idealized sense, of course, what Joe said is you want to locate the development in high opportunity areas and in places that are served by those transit systems and that infrastructure that you've already invested in, and that where those people can be within walking distance of good job opportunities or transit or close to the central city. You know, it's impossible to reach that ideal perfectly because there's an already built city out there, and so you can't just sort of replace it with the ideal. You have to be strategic and look at where your vacant land is and where your opportunities are, and so the map is never going to look like a perfect planner's diagram.
This is the danger of coming up with policy questions based on OPB stories, but Rick Battestio argues that we should have more like duplexes, triplexes, sort of like non-big apartments, but non-single family structures. And it was my vague impression that he was saying that there's too many places we don't allow that. So I just wanted to ask you guys to hold forth on that question for a moment.
That was actually part of what I was commenting on earlier. Yes, there are in single family zones, except on corners, you can't do that. So, but the question I wanted to follow up on yours is, we did a huge swath of multifamily zoning in outer southeast, in the outer southeast plan. Are we planning to dial that back?
Well, let me let's start with your question, Commissioner. We're not dialing that back. We're doing some strategic sort of reductions in East Portland, but in response to the constraint of David Douglas School District, and Eric can explain that more. So there's very limited dialing back. What we're interested in is maybe taking advantage of some of the comp plan designations we put in place in the 80s, but actually following up with some of the zoning. There's a lot of, for instance, R2.5, the townhouse zone that's in the comp plan designation that we've never upzoned or zoned.
So I think, to be fair, when we did the outer southeast plan, we didn't have a strategic plan for how to provide the infrastructure to make that level of density work. So I'm going to be very interested in having that discussion. Before we continue on, I wanted to follow up on your comment on fair housing, because that's one of the things I'm concerned about. I love all the emphasis that you've got in housing access in the way it's described in the proposed comp plan. And then looking back on the current comp plan and the fair housing section is much more specific on exactly what do we mean by fair housing and what are we going to do about it. So I'm concerned that we're, in broadening the scope, we're losing some of the details and the actual
topic. I might be able to help a little bit with that. The Housing Bureau prepares a fair housing plan every 5 years, and we're working on it now, and we'll present it to you next year. This, of course, is a 20-year plan, which has been some 35 years since it was actually completely overhauled. So it may be more appropriate for the specific fair housing policies to be revisited more frequently than you have the ability to do so in the comp plan. As part of that, there's an analysis to impediments to fair housing, which allows us to sort of identify issues. One issue, which you heard a lot about yesterday, is the disparate impact that the no-cause eviction may be having on people of color. If we can factually point to that as a trend, a demonstrable, quantifiable trend, then we can address it in the context of the fair housing plan. Indeed. Yeah, and I think it's fast enough moving that you might want to do it more often than every 20 years. And the fair housing plan is countywide. We prepare it on behalf of Multnomah County and on behalf of the city of Gresham. So there's an opportunity to talk about those edges of East Portland that intersect with Gresham and obviously with Multnomah County as well.
Well, in the comprehensive plan is a 2025-year plan, and I believe the commission and the housing advocates wanted to get reference to fair housing in the comprehensive plan to advocate for it. And as we make these longer-range policy and land use decisions, just like you were talking about, having to evaluate decisions in the nearer term to comply with the Fair Housing Act, to make the point that our longer-range land use and investment decisions should at least evaluate their potential impact or harms vis-a-vis the fair housing outcomes. So that's really fair housing policy lives somewhere else in the city system mainly. This link was just made to the long range.
I think that's a broader observation in the comp plan. You're going to see a number of places where the 1980 plan had some details that we've taken out, and in some cases it's because those details are now in a much bigger plan that's outside the covers of the comp plan, and so it's a little different relationship than we had in 1980.
I'd still like some reference to it, though. If we're doing an annual fair housing plan, there might be some way of incorporating some of these 1980 objectives into it, because the current plan looks like it's got a lot more teeth than the fairly broad objectives here. So perhaps you and I could talk about that.
Before we move on, let's give Howard a chance to get a word in.
Oh, it's been quiet too long. I apologize for being late. Howard Shapiro, for those of you who I don't know. I think what's kind of missing here is our, I guess, fixation on our boundaries and borders. There are partners within the scope of our purview that we should be courting, I think, actively. Form Forward is a good example of people who have ways and means to help us with the affordable issue. Transition Projects, REACH, those are all good community developers. But beside that, what I think we found in our work is that there are just an endless number of good private people who want to do quality, affordable housing if they're given the ways and means to do it. And I think that's what we're struggling with here, is to make that and make that possible. I do, though, want to stress the fact that I think partnerships in developing this kind of housing are really important, because growingly the work population is moving between counties, cities, and so forth, and housing needs to accommodate that. Thank you.
Just follow up on that for a second, Howard, because
The other piece of that is we live in a region. And one of the things that has struck me, Joe, as we're having this conversation, is that the comp plan forces us to do some projections and planning on a city and countywide basis. But our whole philosophy of growth and the future vitality of our state is dependent on a healthy, integrated region. And right now, some of our values and our planning principles are at odds with our regional partners. And I think the classic example is the fact that we're making huge projections for the need to accommodate low-income families and individuals and how we're going to deal with poverty. And all that's going to happen is the gap between our participation and our addressing that problem relative to our percentage of the regional population is going to continue to get out of whack. And, I mean, so I appreciate that the comp plan is forcing us, is focusing us on, you know, what's within our boundaries. But I guess I'm asking a philosophical question. How can we really do this planning exercise without having regional partners that share some of our values? And are we not at risk of deepening the divide where we have half the population and we meet three quarters of the region's need, which financially is not within our reach?
At the metro table is I'm not that deep into the regional sort of politics of housing, so I'm. But at the metro tables, metro for sure is trying to advance this regional affordable housing agenda for the very same reasons you're talking about. It's not solvable by Portland alone, and our economics are such that the households here could well be more prevalent in the rest of the region than they are in Portland because of our overall housing prices. So that's about the extent that I know about the regional sort of appetite or willingness to engage in this discussion. Metro is trying to advance it, and this is not what you're talking about, but you know the flip side is this Joe Courtright sort of framing of the need for great urban places that, you know, that's what people want to buy now. Part of our solution, too, in Portland is that there are more choices like that in the region. People want to live in these denser, amenity-rich urban places, and to the extent that our sister cities out there become more like that, there's more choices than just Portland, and so it helps our overall affordability as well.
Well, so we have to. So the prediction is, will it happen because of market forces? Will it happen because of metro planning? Or it'll happen because HUD brings a lawsuit? I think I know where I land on that one, but we'll come back to this in 10 years.
I would just add real quickly on this subject, I think Portland has a compelling argument to all of the rest of the region. If you look at the chart that has the percentage of low-income people that we are to have in 2035, if we do a bad job and the housing prices go up and we're not able to accommodate that percentage, we have a much lower percentage. They don't come to Portland. They go to every other city in the region, let's say, in Clark County. We, as a city, luckily are, I think, better prepared to accommodate that percentage of people in terms of low income, in terms of systems of schooling, transportation, and all of those things. If we do a bad job, can Tualatin and the other cities accommodate them and take care of the infrastructure costs? Because they're going to drive and get to their jobs. They're not close to their jobs. The health care, all of these things that the other counties will have to absorb because they're their population now. In one sense, it's better business for us because we have lower income, we have a higher income as a gross, but it's bad business for other people. And I think that's just a business discussion of, hopefully we do a good job in keeping a broad perspective of our clientele. And I mean, the infrastructure costs are astronomical to accommodate them, much less schooling and healthcare and a number of other high cost items that have to come along with that population.
Another related dynamic there is the transportation planning that happens at the regional level that you know, if we're not successful and our entire service sector has to live in Gresham and Beaverton and Hillsborough, and we're going to have some serious transportation problems. And so there's a hook to the metro regional discussion on that level, too.
So I'd like to cycle back to the question that Commissioner Novick originally asked, and then we'll move on to the next session, if that's okay with you. But the question about proposals that are out there, and there's a variety. Rick Potestio has one of, are we being far-sighted enough by if we are not pursuing more mid-rise or